From the Los Angeles Times, this is The Envelope, the podcast, your ultimate guide to award season. I'm one of your hosts, Yvonne Villarreal.
And I'm your other host, Mark Olson. Every week, our podcast showcases key voices across both TV and film.
Mark, I just want to tell you that not too long ago, I went out for a long walk in Griffith Park, and I met five dogs along the way. So I'm coming to you really comforted, and I feel like we're going to have a really good episode. How are you doing?
Well, the other day I went for a walk in my neighborhood, kind of mid-city, and I met a coyote, and I was kind of surprised by that. So,
was he nice?
He just darted down another street, and you know, we did not have a long encounter, but it was fine.
Well, I'm back in the interviewing chair on next week's episode of our podcast. But this week, once again, I'm letting you take it away. Who are you talking to?
We have two guests, actor Mads Mikkelsen and director Thomas Vinterberg. Their new collaborations on the film Another Round, which has been nominated for two Oscars, both Best International Feature, and Thomas got something of a surprise Best Director nomination as well. Mads stars as a high school teacher who's having kind of a midlife crisis. He feels just the life has gone out of his life. And he and a group of other teachers try out this theory that they learned that maybe people naturally have too low of a blood alcohol content. And so they start day drinking.
To begin with, we just looked at world history and we saw how many fantastic and great accomplishments that have been done by people who are actually drunk. And we wanted to make a celebration of alcohol. And that developed into a more ambitious project of making a film about the whole nature of alcohol, also the dark sides. And then in the process of writing, we again wanted to elevate this to be about more than just drinking. We wanted it to be about life in all humbleness.
We didn't bring any libations to recording our podcast today, Mark. Very disappointed in us, but I'm looking forward to hearing this conversation. We'll get to it in just a couple minutes.
Hi, this is Harry Lipman, LA Times legal columnist and host of the Talking Feds podcast, a roundtable discussion that brings together prominent former government officials, journalists, and special guests. This year, we're covering everything you need to know about the presidential transition with guests that include Valerie Jarrett, Senator Amy Klobuchar, and Congressman Jamie Raskin. So tune in everywhere that you find podcasts.
Mark's conversation with Thomas Vinterberg and Mads Mikkelsen is up next. But first, let's pass the mic over to our columnist Glenn Whipp for his awards minute.
The Screen Actors Guild Awards are on Sunday, and this is the last stand for any kind of wrinkle in the Best Picture Oscar race, because Nomadland last week won the Producers Guild's top prize, Best Picture. And because the Producers Guild shares a lot of members with the Academy, uses the same ballot system as the Academy, it's like more likely than ever that Nomadland is going to win Best Picture. But it's not nominated for the Screen Actors Guild Ensemble Prize. And if you've seen the movie, you can probably figure out why. It's mostly non-professional actors working with Frances McDormand. So what could win SAG Awards Ensemble? Here's the other wrinkle here. Of the five movies nominated, three of them weren't nominated for Best Picture. The Five Bloods wasn't nominated, Ma Rainey's Black Bottom, One Night in Miami, none of these movies nominated. So only two films, Trial of the Chicago 7 and Minari, have a shot at winning SAG and then going on to say, hey, we won SAG Ensemble. Maybe you should consider us for Best Picture. I guess that's possible. Both earned a lot of Oscar nominations, both pretty well-liked, Minari more than Chicago 7. So this is it. This is the last chance, I think, for some movie to kind of step up, have its moment in the spotlight and say, consider us. Because right now, it's looking like Nomadland has this pretty much in the bag.
Mm-hmm.
We are really in the thick of it now with the Guild Awards. And this is kind of when, you know, the sort of woozy, hazy aspect of award season really takes shape. But thanks to Glenn, as always, things are really sort of like becoming clear about who's winning, who's like really competitive. So see what happens over the next few weeks.
Are you in any Oscar pools, Mark?
No.
I'm still trying to get my friends to like watch some of these films. That's where I'm at. But enough about us. Now here's your interview with Mads Mikkelsen and Thomas Vinterberg about Another Round.
Mads and Thomas, thanks to both of you for being here today. Thomas, I'm going to begin with a question for you. How did you come across this idea of the Norwegian psychiatrist Finn Skårderud that he believes that the human body has a blood alcohol content that should just naturally be a little higher than it is? Where did you even come across this idea?
Well, this theory actually comes from a real existing psychiatrist with the same name, Finn Skårderud. And he actually said that, and we were trying to sort of elevate it into a scientific situation in our movie. Whereas for him, it was pretty much just something he said.
And Mads, how did Thomas kind of present the idea of the movie to you? What did you think when you first heard this theory?
I thought, yeah, of course, the theory is right. I don't think you have to be a scientist to figure out that that is true. We all know what two glasses of wine can do to a conversation. We know that very few of us have met our spouses if there wasn't alcohol involved. So it's been around for 6,000-7,000 years, either to, you know, forget your miserable life or to become creative or get closer to the spirit. And it can do magnificent things. But there is obviously a very big difference between two glasses of wine and two bottles of wine.
And now, had the two of you been looking for a new project to do together since you had made The Hunt? I mean, that movie was a real success for the both of you, was nominated for an Academy Award. Mads, you won Best Actor at Cannes. Had the two of you wanted to work together again since The Hunt?
Yes, absolutely. I'm not finding projects. That's Thomas's turf. We both loved the first process so much that we knew that eventually we would do something together. And then it took 7 years, might have been a mistake, but I'm glad it happened.
Because Thomas, you actually wrote this part for Mads?
Yeah, I wrote this part for Mads. I love working with Mads, and I'm always on the lookout for something for us to do. We're friends, we're neighbors, and he's the best actor you can get. So this was a dream situation for me. It came true. Again, he was brilliant.
You guys are actually neighbors?
Yeah, kind of neighbors. I mean, neighbors, like 200 meters?
Yeah, something like that.
It's still pretty close.
When Mads is actually home, we do workout and stuff together, you know? It's cozy.
It is. We dance together.
And then, Thomas, how did you and your co-writer, Tobias Lindholm, how did you kind of extrapolate, you know, this blood alcohol theory into a story of, like, kind of male middle-aged crisis?
Well, I got to remind you that this is an idea that has developed over years. To begin with, we just looked at world history and we saw how many fantastic and great accomplishments that have been done by people who are actually drunk. And we wanted to make a celebration of alcohol. And that developed into a more ambitious project of making a film about the whole nature of alcohol, also the dark sides. And then in the process of writing, we again wanted to elevate this to be about more than just drinking. We wanted it to be about life in all humbleness. We wanted it to be a life-affirming film. The word spirit does not only mean alcohol. And making it a movie about four guys who've lost the appetite for their lives, their curiosity, the element of risk, the element of exploration, was something that came to us when we decided to put this at a school amongst school teachers. So the combination of that theory and the idea of putting this at a school sort of made the ball rolling.
Because Mads, did that make sense to you? I've heard you say in some other interviews that originally the character was going to be an air traffic controller, I think. Like, for you, did it really kind of click in and make sense once he became a school teacher?
Yeah, it made sense on so many different levels. One of the reasons why it's so much more interesting to have all four characters in the school is that you can actually show the friendship between them without having a ton of extra scenes, because this is where they work, this is where they hang out, this is where they see each other. And secondly, and maybe even most importantly, There is the mirror image of these guys who are standing on the platform and the train has left them. But they're watching every single day into the faces of youth, into the immortal faces that they used to be themselves. There's hope in that. There's also very depressing for them to be confronted with that every single day. So the film starts with these youngsters and it finishes with these youngsters' immortality.
And Thomas, is that part of why it made sense for you to have them be school teachers as well? I'm really taken with that idea that these guys, they're watching life, their lives pass them by, and they're also watching these kids pass them by year after year.
Right. We thought it was a great sort of mirror to put in front of these four guys, to have the sense of weightlessness and hope and inspiration right in front of them. Also, I think it's a very vulnerable position to be a teacher. It's a bit like ambitious sharks sitting out there. And when they smell insecurity, the teacher's killed. And I've seen that live action in my own life. Of course, making them teachers also opened the doors into a little bit of a higher intellectual level than an airport controller. It gave us the opportunity to talk about Churchill and psychology, philosophy, all of these things, which I think gave a lot to the project, actually.
Because that aspect of the film, that these character, Mads' character in particular, just feels so stuck in his life. There's a moment where he asks his wife, "Have I become boring?" And I found that scene so heartbreaking and something so devastating in that line. Mads, what did that scene, what did that moment mean to you?
It meant that we're dealing with a man who's been walking around like a comfortable numb for a long time, and it's starting to dawn on him what kind of a situation he's in. And the peak of that scene is actually taking place a little later when he has this dinner scene with his friends, where he for the first time realizes he's not happy with his past and he's jealous on the future and he's simply forgotten to live in the present. It's a very bold scene because it takes place within 12 minutes, I believe, or something, and my character has a smaller breakdown at a dinner table, something you would normally place an hour and a half into the film. But Thomas wanted to, instead of knowing the characters too well at this point, he wanted that scene to make the audience get to know us.
And tell me more about that dinner party scene, Mads. I mean, there's something just so fragile in your performance there. What is a moment like that like?
It's kind of wonderful in one sense. It's also very lonely in a different sense. The way that it was written, and Thomas and Tobias had been writing it, was that the world ceased to exist for a while, and we go into his bubble. He hears his friends. He's hearing the people who are singing next door, but the camera goes closer and closer on this character and inside his mind, which is the only way we can pull it off. If it was just me doing that in a normal shot scene, it would probably be a little, what's wrong with this guy? But this time it was a different approach. Thomas was very adamant about, we are leaving the scene and we enter this man now.
Thomas, can you talk a little bit about why you wanted to shoot the scene in that way?
Yeah, I mean, this scene is a key scene for the movie. It kind of contains the whole process of the movie in one scene. It was by far the most challenging and most important of them, except from the ending, I guess. As Mads touched upon, it was kind of unusual to have a breakdown of the main character on page 19. But I enjoyed that because it was like, okay, I hope this would give the audience a sense of what can happen from here if he's already crying. But what he's doing there is that he's losing control. And that's what I've been told that this movie is about by my clever wife. She's more clever than I am. It's about the uncontrollable. And that's what happens to him. He lets go. Suddenly the tears are just rolling and he's just giving in and he's letting go of his emotions. And it's a miniature version of what's going to happen for the next 1.5 hours in the movie.
But I think that that's a feeling that just about everyone can recognize, that having that moment where you're wondering, like, who am I? What has my life become? How did I get here? Mads, for you, was that a feeling that you recognized at all? Like, did you understand kind of where this character was at that moment?
I fully understood him, and I recognize him to a degree, maybe not as drastic as the situation he's in. I am, in many ways, the counter-opposite of this character. I do enjoy that the sun is rising every morning, and I am quite curious. I'm always like, what's behind that building? I'll go for a walk and see. Where this guy, he has lost his curiosity completely. But I can identify with it. And luckily, I don't have to be like my characters. That's the whole trick.
Mark, the scene is a lot about togetherness. and what role alcohol plays in this togetherness. They meet up as four very lonely guys with a low level of communication. And then they get some vodka and things changes. I don't know, Mark, how many married couples, you know, who've met each other sober. It's a damn good liquor when it comes to togetherness, right? And the scene is very much about that in its own simplicity.
But then as much fun as the movie has with the drinking, once these men sort of launch this project, it also never makes light of it. It always understands that there is a darker side to this. And I think we see the cost of that. Thomas, was it important to you that as fun as the movie can be in its depiction of what they're doing, that it's always aware of how kind of dangerous this can be?
I think in my younger days, in my provocative 20s, I would have sticked to a pure and simple celebration of alcohol. But I felt it was not really truthful. And I also felt sort of a moral obligation, which is normally not something I'm navigating towards. But it is, after all, you know, it's a socially accepted liquor that elevates situations, make people marry, make great world leaders, make great decisions, results in great art. But it's also something that destroys families and takes lives. I found that a part of the story. And if we wanted this to be truthful, we had to tell that story as well. And also, a film is like a bit like a symphony. And Mats's catharsis at the end of the movie, it would have been less interesting if there wouldn't have been the half hour of the dark side right before that. Of course, Dan, Mats can dance himself out of everything, and it's beautiful, and it would always have worked. But I believe that since we've been visiting the other side of drinking before that, it's a great revelation.
Because Mats is sort of acting drunk, you know, performing as drunk. Is it fun? Like, in particular, say, the Sazerac scene when the four men are, like, having kind of a house party, they're drinking, they're dancing. Are scenes like that fun, or is it, like, a real challenge to have to be performing drunk?
We like things to be direct in Denmark. Why don't you ask me if he was drunk? That's where we come from.
It was fun. I mean, it is intoxicating to stand there with four of your good friends and behave like kids. It's smitten, you know, it catches on. Even though we were not drinking in those scenes, Thomas would have as hard a time trying to get through to us because we became intoxicated by the scenes. But it's also a challenge. And for that, we had a nice and good boot camp before where we shot each other on video and we tested out the philosophy about 005, 008. And we noticed that while we were in the situation, it felt kind of normal. We didn't feel there was a lot of things happening. When watching the video later, you could realize that we did behave differently. And there's a big difference between two glasses and four glasses. All of a sudden, your hands are doing stuff that you were not aware of, or you start lisping on certain words. So that was a really good inspiration to do the boot camp. But it is a challenge. You can easily step wrong when you do drunk scenes, and we were there for each other, and Thomas was there. And it's nice to be good friends because then you can laugh at each other in a good way and make sure we come back on the right track.
So just to be clear, since Thomas brought this up, were you ever actually drinking?
Nope.
I did not serve alcohol on set, but we served quite a bit of alcohol in that boot camp before. I consider them professionals and treat them as professionals. These are actors, so I'm asking them to act. I did ask them a lot. I asked them to do a refined, detailed, emotional journey. I asked them to be funny. I asked them to be tragic and to be drunk in very specific levels. So I did challenge them a lot, but just giving them a bottle of whiskey would be complicated and, I guess, an element of amateurism.
But you can do that if it's a complete ballistic rock and roll scene, obviously, and you can get something that's maybe quite interesting as well. But Thomas's job was, in many regards, when we're doing the teaching scenes, you know, we do the take, and he would come in and say, listen, let's put the volume up. Let's go up to 0.1 now. And then we will give that a shot, and that, nah, no, let's go back to 0.50, whatever. And you would not be able to do that, obviously, if you were just drinking. There would only be one way the volume button would go, and that would be up, up, up. And I don't think we would have survived it anyways if we had to drink for 40 days straight.
But, Mark, there's been these surveys with youngsters in a bar, where half of them are given mojitos and the other half are given virgin mojitos secretly. And then they have to fill out this schedule after. And they're all supposedly equally drunk. So as Matt said before, you're intoxicated by the situation. If you look at the opening of the film, you see the youngsters run around the lake. They weren't served any alcohol at all, but they got crazy and they wanted to go out and they didn't ever want to stop shooting. It was a ball shooting that, but there was no alcohol involved.
I believe that experiment you're referring to, I believe I have a memory that you could actually measure in their blood that they got intoxicated, the ones who didn't drink. I might be wrong, but I think I'm right.
You might be wrong, but...
Yeah, let's look into it. It's interesting.
Our nation has endured. Let's make sure the facts do, too. Pay $1 for 8 weeks and get a perspective unlike anywhere else. Go to latimes.com/subscribe. Los Angeles Times, the state of what's next.
Hey, this is Andy Bernstein, Hall of Fame photographer for the NBA and host of the Legends of Sport podcast. For the past 3 seasons, we've spoken to icons such as Magic Johnson, Steve Kerr, Jerry West, and Sue Bird. And not just from the world of basketball, but legends of all sports, including owners, superfans, and members of the sports media. Find new episodes of Legends of Sport on the LA Times app or wherever you get your favorite podcasts.
See, this is the type of podcast you gotta have.
Thomas, I want to be sure to ask you, the other characters, besides from Mads' characters, you just do such a great job of, like, every one of those men have a really full story. And I think we get to know them so well. And so as the story goes along and some of them meet unfortunate ends, it really is very emotional. Was it important to you that those, you know, other characters, that all of them have a really full life and a full story?
Oh, yeah. I mean, there's no such thing as a small part. They all need a full life and a full story. And what you see on the screen is only 1% of what Tobias Lindholm, the co-writer, and myself is plotting out for them. There's a past that they constantly refer to. In Matt's case, did some dancing and some very successful early years as a teacher. And there's their dreams about the future and all their secrets. And there's a full life around the film, which we have to do a map out for each one of the characters to make this look believable.
I know, I don't think I've read a single review or interview or article about the movie that has not mentioned the final dance number. Are the two of you surprised that it's become as sort of popular and like the signature scene of the movie? Mads, are you surprised that the dance number has become so popular?
Not now, but if you ask me while we were in the midst of shooting, absolutely. I was, and Thomas can elaborate on this, I was quite reluctant. Not that I didn't want to dance in the film. I was just, I had a hard time picturing how we could pull it off without coming across as pretentious. It's a realistic film. So in my world, we should heighten it. We should be a drunken man's fantasy, something that was standing out of the film. And Thomas was insisting on, no, this man gets up and he starts flying. So we went back and forth quite a few times, and I luckily I gave in, and he was absolutely 100% right. But if you ask me a year ago, I didn't see that coming. When I see the film now, it makes all perfect sense.
Thomas?
Well, we've always been nervous about this scene. It's a bit of a stretch having a teacher suddenly being a great, almost professional dancer. But emotionally, it just made so much sense to all of us, and I always pursued it. I felt it was so right that he becomes weightless. All these youngsters are weightless, and at this time in life, everyone is yearning for that time, for the weightlessness of youth. So it just made sense he would be dancing amongst these students at the end. Now, Tobias is a reality rules kind of guy. Mats is too, I guess, to some extent, and I am too. So we really had to work out how to prepare this so it became believable. So if you look at the scene itself, and actually the whole story of Mats' dance, it's all about his reluctance, the character's reluctance to dance from this dinner scene in the beginning and to the end. Even in the scene, he's like dancing a little bit, retreating, then dancing a little bit more, and then finally gives in, which all in all describes the process pretty well. How
it was. And then like a heavenly coincidence, which was not part of the choice of the music, we just loved the song, but not until I saw it the second time I realized what they're singing is actually, I don't care what anyone thinks, I just want to be young again for 5 minutes. Just give me 5 minutes. That kind of sums up exactly what we wanted to do with that scene. And then on top of that, the guy is actually singing it.
We wanted this end to be a bit like a very old film called Zorba the Greek, in which they describe their dance on the beach after something has fallen apart for them. They call it a beautiful catastrophe. And that sums up how this film ends somehow, as a beautiful catastrophe. Someone died and someone is dancing. And by the way, it sums up my life pretty well as well.
Mads, there's such a sense of catharsis for the character in that dance. Would you say the same was true for you? With, like, I don't know if you've wanted to dance in a movie at all. You have a background as a dancer before you were acting. Was it meaningful to you to be able to dance in a movie in this way? Was it sort of a release for you too?
Those 2 days of shooting was maybe the most meaningful days of shooting I've ever had. But not because I finally got the chance to dance. It's because I've never been ambitious about doing that in a film. But because it was such an important ending for a variety of reasons, but obviously for very extremely private and personal reasons for Thomas, it became catharsis, and those 2 days were extremely beautiful to be part of.
I have to say, I think one of my favorite things about the dance is that you're holding a beer through like the whole thing, and I feel like if nothing else, just holding a beer and dancing and drinking, that seems like a real challenge.
Yeah, that was a little Rat Pack thing we threw in there. We added that actually in an early stage where Olivia, who did the choreography, she did some crazy beautiful moves, and I was like, we got to personalize it a little, so we added that beer. We made that the center of the whole thing.
And now the movie has been a big commercial hit there in Denmark, and also recently at the European Film Awards, it won 4 top prizes, including Best Director, Best Actor, and Best Film. Thomas, why do you think audiences are responding so strongly to the movie?
Well, this movie comes from the heart, Mark. There's a great sense of honesty and an element of love on screen amongst those guys. I think it speaks to people's hearts, basically. It also speaks into a world of confinement and a world of death and bankruptcy. And there's an element of riot against that in our movie. There's a lot of people dancing, holding each other, drinking at odd times, allowing, again, the element of the uncontrollable to take over their lives, whereas we're all over the place living very controlled and confined lives. And then Mads is really good. The actors are really good. And I'm okay. And it all adds up, you know?
I think we were all a little nervous that it came out in the midst of the lockdown, that some people might find it offensive or provoking. And it had the exactly opposite reaction to it. And people were not interested in watching a film about COVID-19. They wanted to see a film about their life we had. And the reason why it travels as well, yes, it is a demonstration to a degree of drinking culture in Denmark, but not that far off what you have in other countries as well. There might be like details that are different or different variation with how much your young people drinks, but we all countries have a relationship to alcohol to a degree. But that's just the kickstart of the film. The entire film is about embracing life, and I think that's exactly what people are getting out of this film.
You know, Mark, in Denmark, it's been a massive box office success, one of the biggest we've had. And I think one of the reasons is that it speaks to a huge variety of ages and kinds of people. We have 19-year-old people with a bag of beer under their arms on their way to town, watching the movie for the 4th time, giggling. And then we have, right next to them, we have anonymous alcoholics who find that the movie's about them. Tobias and I insisted that this film would be open. It wouldn't be moralistic, and it would not be an alcohol ad as well. You can decide whether he's flying or falling at the end, which might annoy some people because it's not that conclusive as we're used to. It gives an opportunity for quite a few people, and almost everyone has some kind of relation and some kind of important relation to alcohol.
I want to make sure to just ask both of you, Mads in particular, you've both done English language projects, worked, you know, outside of Denmark. Is it meaningful to you, Mads, when you're working in Denmark in the Danish language, is that now something even more special to you? Is that even more meaningful to you now that you've had so much success outside of Denmark?
I wouldn't put it that way. It's been meaningful from the very get-go. It has to be meaningful when you do things, also when you do things in America that is not your native tongue. There are a variety of reasons why it's meaningful to come back. And in this case, the most important meaningfulness was obviously that Thomas asked me and I wanted to work with him. And I loved the script. Coming back home and do it in your own native tongue is also a relief. But maybe so, it's your culture, it's your stories. It is something you can relate to in a different way than you can in other types of stories. I think that might be one of the most important things why it is necessary to go home and tell your own stories.
Thomas, is it meaningful to you now when you're making films in Denmark in the Danish language?
Right, it is meaningful. I think I feel a bit like Mads. I enjoy the to-ing and fro-ing from Denmark because there's something very exciting about going to a different country, meeting a different culture, meeting foreign people. It's like you set yourself up more. Then you come back to your family, which is your film crew, which you always work with, and people come with their obnoxious jokes again. You know, it's just a different thing. And the variation of these things seems lively and good.
And then just my last question for both of you, you know, this past year, people had to spend so much time just indoors. People have been spending so much time just watching things, you know, TV series, movies. Mads, have you watched anything over the last year or so that was really meaningful to you that you'd want to recommend to other people?
Well, I'm the wrong guy to ask. Even though I'm an actor of profession, I rarely watch films or TV shows. I tend to watch sports. Can be a lot of reasons for that. I like to get my inspiration from real life, and I find myself working a little when I watch films. I do enjoy watching sports a lot. But I have seen quite a few things, though, and at this very point, I mean, I'm obviously one of the guys who saw Tiger King, so but I don't have to recommend that one. Everybody knows about it.
Wait, so who's your team? Like, what sports do you like to watch?
I tend to support the teams that are winning, and if they're not, I'll just swap them out really fast. But I'm a Barcelona guy, and I love Messi.
And Thomas, is there anything that you've watched, you know, during your time in quarantine that you'd want to recommend to other people?
Well, yeah, I've seen a lot. I mean, I'm an Academy member, so I see a lot of great movies. And there's been plenty of good movies. I saw Sofia Coppola's movie lately, which I really enjoyed, The Rocks. I enjoyed that. I enjoyed the Norwegian Oscar contender, Hope. There's been plenty to pick from.
Mark, that was a great interview, but I just love the idea of picturing Mads watching Tiger King because he's so not the person I would imagine as someone to watch that. He seems like quite the character. What was your impression of him while speaking to him?
I mean, I've actually interviewed him a couple times over the years, and he is just a great interview. He's so sort of candid and refreshing. It actually was funny, like while we were doing the interview, he sort of started smoking cigarettes, which isn't something we usually see anymore. And especially on a Zoom, there was something kind of like really thrilling about it. And it's funny because I keep thinking about how, you know, as they've been promoting this and Thomas has been in Copenhagen where he lives, Mads has largely been in London. He's shooting a movie there. And so the Zoom aspect of it has been a little awkward. But I keep thinking how if they were having to promote this in like, you know, normal times, how many people would be trying to get them to drink or like we want to go drinking with Thomas and Mads to promote the movie? So I think in some ways, like they've been saved from that in some ways because of having to, you know, promote the movie while not being in the same city and over Zoom.
Well, I also like that you asked him about the iconic dance scene at the end, which was inspired by Zorba the Greek. Like, I would not have expected Mads to sort of hypnotize me in that way with his dance moves. It was quite like the scene to sort of see unfold.
Well, he is a trained dancer. He was a dancer before he was an actor. And
yeah, I had no idea.
It's a little surprising when you first hear that. But then when you think about it, there is a gracefulness to his physicality, the way that he moves, that it kind of makes total sense. I do just like so much that scene has become so iconic so quickly. It's already been memed a little bit. Like there's something that like just so wonderful about that scene in particular. And he's just so great and so free. And it's really exciting to see, and especially from these two guys that make, you know, sometimes these very serious kind of, you know, slightly downbeat movies, to have this movie that, even for the darkness that's within it, ends on such a sort of a joyous note is really terrific.
Right. Well, I even like what he said about, you don't know if he's flying or falling at the end, and sort of living with your own idea of what exactly is the sort of resolution there. I have my own ideas, but anyway, Mads is watching Tiger King. What have you been watching this week?
Well, I, you know, the other day I told you I'd watched season one of The Nick, and so I'm pretty deep into season two of The Nick now. But what about you? What have you been watching?
Well, I told you I started WandaVision, and I was using, you know, Tracy's sort of write-ups as a guide. But I was also babysitting my nephew, and he started giving me his own guide on what the series is. And he's 7. No, he's 6. And I'm like, how do you know so much about this? But so with Tracy and my nephew, I'm really starting to embrace it. I've also started watching a little bit of I Love Lucy. I don't know. I'm just in that mood of, I need some uplifting. So that's what I've been watching. I've watched some new series that are coming out but are sort of under wraps right now that I can't talk about. So when I can, I'll be sure to mention them.
No, wait, no. How does your nephew get all the sitcom references and stuff? Like what? Like, or does it just not matter?
No. He for sure does not get that. No. But it doesn't matter. He's still like able to tell me like the sort of ins and outs of the world. So it's been helpful. I didn't expect it. He also made me watch a lot of Cat in the Hat. Martin Short is the voice of the cat. So it's been interesting. You know, I'm really broadening my horizons here, Mark.
You know, I also watched this movie from 1993 called The Remains of the Day. It's based on the Kazu Ishiguro novel that it stars current Academy Award nominee Anthony Hopkins and also Emma Thompson. It's such a great movie. You know, it's funny. It's a Merchant Ivory production. So directed by James Ivory, produced by Ishmael Merchant, from a screenplay by Ruth Prior Jabavla, their frequent collaborator. And it's funny how like Merchant Ivory is so much like the Grateful Dead, where it's like you really want to like blame them for all the like fake imitators that followed them. But then when you actually like watch the Merchant Ivory movies, they're just incredible. And this one is so good. It's like, it's about like a romance that never quite gets going. Hopkins plays a butler at this big estate. And then Emma Thompson is a younger woman who comes as the sort of housekeeper. And just because of circumstances and sort of position and manners, they're just never, this connection between them is never quite able to like blossom in the way that it should. So it's just like a fantastic movie that I'd seen many years ago, but kind of didn't get it at the time. And when I saw it just this time, it just really knocked me out. It's terrific.
Uh-huh.
And it's available on some of your rental platforms.
I'll have to check that out, Mark. I love Emma Thompson.
And so, Yvonne, we're going to be talking TV again next week. Who are you going to be talking to?
I know. I just feel so bad, Mark. Like, with Oscar season, you've had to really take over a lot of the conversations that we've had. But I'm going to give you a little bit of a break. I'm talking to actor Kate Mara, and she plays a high school teacher on the FX on Hulu series, A Teacher. And she gets involved with her teenage student.
Yeah, I do think it's important to sort of open that conversation up to both the predator and the survivor, you know, having empathy for all different types of people, you know.
You know, I'm so excited for that conversation. I was such a fan of the feature film, also called A Teacher, that was, you know, written and directed by Hannah Fadel, who then, you know, also made the series. And so I'm really excited to kind of hear from Kate and about what that process of sort of like expanding on the feature was like.
Yeah, I think it's really interesting. I think a lot of people came in feeling one way about the relationship and where the series was going in its exploration of it. And sort of the way it ended, I think a lot of people had some thoughts about it. So it was nice to talk to her about it. But yeah, that's coming up next week. The Envelope, the podcast, is hosted by me, Yvonne Villarreal, and by my colleague, Mark Olson. Our executive producer is Abby Fentress-Swanson. Our audio engineer is Mike Heflin. And special thanks to Mike for making our theme song.
If you like The Envelope, the podcast, subscribe wherever you get your podcasts, and leave us a 5-star review on Apple.
The Envelope is created by the journalists at the LA Times. Right now, access to facts has never been more important, and the Times is in the business of reporting them. Stay connected and subscribe, because your subscription supports the production of podcasts like this one and our award-winning journalism. Visit latimes.com/supportlatimes to subscribe.
Thanks for listening, and we'll see you next week.